Morning.
Good morning.
We have about 20 people at our retreat in southern Minnesota this morning. So I guess we're all sitting together, although I think their situation is a little more rugged than ours. So. Although I think the weather has been pretty good. Come on in. There's room in here. So this morning I'm going to continue the theme of my last talk, and I'm going to just review a little bit from my last talk. So I'm talking about the polarity, the duality of delusion and enlightenment. Because if in Buddhism is about anything, it is about enlightenment. And last time I talked about two traditional Buddhist attitudes toward enlightenment, and then I went into the third, which is Dogen's, the founder of the Soto School of Zen. So today I'm going to just review that stuff briefly and then talk more about some of Dogen's writings about this. Okay, so the first one, delusion and enlightenment. Delusion here, enlightenment there, or the other way around. And we have a path. We've got a nice eightfold path all laid out for us, right? Right understanding, right thought. Well, let's say correct. People don't like right and wrong. So let's say correct understanding, correct thought, correct speech, correct action, correct livelihood, and then we get to the meditative component. Correct effort in our meditation, correct mindfulness in our meditation, correct concentration in our meditation. And we move from dukkha to sukha. We move from dissatisfaction to joy. Nice path. Okay, so that's one. I'm not talking about that one today. It's a good one. It's a good one. I mean, there's all good. It's not like there's the Dogen's is the best. I mean, this is just the one that we practice more because it's in our lineage. That's a good one, as I said last time, because it gives us a goal. It's sort of clear. It's laid out. We can work toward this. Instead of investing in the stock market, we can invest in this practice. Mm-hmm. And we can yield results. We can invest in the stock market too, but you really have, if you're going to invest in this practice, you have to really invest in it. And then the teacher becomes the model of someone who has invested in the practice for years and then manifests something. And certainly I felt that way about my first two teachers. And the second one then is that enlightenment, the second way of talking about this enlightenment, always here, but it's usually covered up. So it's not from here to here. It's here, covered up. And what's it covered up by? Gunk, right? Gunk. Residue. Foul stuff that comes out of our consciousness that we go over and over again, that we worry and fret about, and that gunks us up. So we're not here. We're not here. We're just gunked up by our past, by our worries about the future. It could be like the past. It could be as bad. It could be worse. Oh, it could be better. So it's good gunk and bad gunk. We say positive and negative gunk. Although that's not a real translation of a Sanskrit word, but. And so with that one, the second one, then it's not about traveling from here to here. It's about, and it's not about investing in something and working hard and just checking your investment every day to see how it's going. Is my zazen okay today? Did I just sit for 30 minutes? Was I spaced out the whole time? It's not that. It's that it's always here. And that all we have to do is let the gunk dissipate. And the gunk is always ready to dissipate if we really stop, if we really look, if we really listen. And we don't have to do anything in particular except just be. Just be. So that comes from the Taoist tradition. That comes from the Taoist tradition, whereas the first one comes from really the early Buddhist Theravadan tradition. Okay, so then the third one, which I'm going to spend the rest of the time talking about, and I talked about for a while last time. I'm not talking about it because it's better. I'm talking about it because, well, I've talked a lot about it. I've given so many talks here, and here's, it's interesting. It's interesting, and it has some relevance. Okay, so the third one. Oh, well, no, before I get about go through the third one, again, the limitations of the first two. Limitations of the first two. One, that both of them have a division between things as they are and things as they appear to be. They both have that limitation. They divide them up. And second, they both value the pre-discriminating state or the extra-discriminating state or the trans-discriminating state more than the discriminating state. So there's a duality. There's a separation. Everybody wants the extra discrimination, the trans discrimination. So we create that duality, and that may not be that healthy. It may not be. It may not be. We've got enough duality already. The third one, that then discriminating activities are less important. Intellectual activities are less important. Language is less important. Reason is less important because we're going for the extra, the transcendental, right? And the fourth limitation is that this can be, there's a division between the empowered and the disempowered. I'm empowered. Suzuki Roshi, when I saw him, he was empowered. I was disempowered. You know, I had all this crud. He was just clear. All I had to do was look at his eyes and I could see he was clear. So I feel disempowered. And the more he's empowered, the more I'm disempowered. And this is the history of religion, history of all spiritual traditions. Well, we should be careful about that dichotomy, don't you think? I think we should. I think we should. It caused a lot of problems in Buddhism, in Christianity, in Judaism, in Muslim, you name it. Probably even in Taoism, but I don't know. I don't know. So Dogen says, and I quoted this last time, you should know that to understand that a greatly enlightened person is nevertheless deluded is the quintessence of practice. The quintessence of practice. Something to look forward to. Great enlightenment is ever intimate with the nevertheless deluded. Great enlightenment is ever intimate, ever close, with a nevertheless deluded. And so Dogen here is hearkening back to 5 centuries to the merging of difference and unity, which we chant here on Saturdays. Right within the light there is darkness, but don't see it as darkness. Right within the darkness there is light, but don't see it as light. He is hearkening back to that, but he is also explaining it and elaborating on it. So he says that his analogy that I used last time is the analogy of the the moon in the night, the moon shining on the earth. The shadows are always there. The earth's always dark, but the moon shines everywhere. And the analogy I used last time was the candle in the darkness. The candle in the darkness. So the candle in the darkness, the moon in the night, doesn't get rid of the darkness. It illuminates the darkness. It doesn't get rid of it. The two are two sides of one reality. And you can say one reality, but they're also very, very different, even though they're the same. And this confuses people, but in their sameness is their difference. In their sameness is their difference. So about 10 years ago, I had a student who was kind of also a friend who was practicing, had been practicing Zazen for maybe 5 years, really with wholeheartedly. And he was meeting with me, and he said something like this. He said, "Well, you know, Tim, I've had problems with relationships with women." And I said, "Yes, I know. Who hasn't? Excuse me." And he said, "Yes." And the deal with him is that he has intense relationships with women, and then things get all tangled up, and he wants to back off, and then she backs off, and then he wants to go. He wants needs her when she backs off, and then he needs a space, and it all goes back to childhood stuff. So much of our karma goes back to childhood stuff. Now, of course, Buddhists like to say, mystical Buddhists, it goes back before childhood, but we don't know about that. I don't know about that. You may know about that. I barely can remember childhood. Dimly remember childhood, right? Somebody tells me it goes back to childhood, my childhood. I say, okay, well, maybe so. Maybe so. So he said, "I've been practicing Zazen for 5 years now." I said, "I know. Remember, I've been helping you, been coaching you." And he said, "And it's getting better." He said, "It's getting better. This woman that I've been with right now, I'm not sure if it's going to work, but at least I feel like I'm not all tied up in knots whenever she goes away from me or comes too close to me." And he said, "But I don't know how much of it is due to my zazen and how much is distancing to protect myself." And I said, "Well, that's interesting. Well, we never really know. We never really know. But if we're distancing, what's going on? We're usually suppressing, repressing, denying. One of those things. Suppression and repression, unconscious and conscious, different ways of denying, different ways of distancing. Whereas real detachment in the Zen sense means also intimacy, means going close to it. You can go close to it. You can really see it. You can see it without developing a huge sort of ruckus about it, a huge drama about it. You can just see it, and that's detachment. If there's detachment at all." I mean, Dogen doesn't really talk much about detachment. He only talks about intimacy. He says the intimacy between the light and the darkness, that the act of meditation is shining the light on the darkness, and that the two exist as interplay. So that zazen, so that meditation sensitizes us to the complexities and the problems of the human condition. That's what it does. And so some people say, "Oh, I've got more problems now." Well, I wonder really if that's the case. I don't think so. I think there's an increased sensitization, an increased openness, less suppression, less repression. And then sometimes you may need to distance yourself. "This is too fast. This is too fast. I need to." Okay, then distance yourself. But don't call it the detachment of your practice, because that's sort of fake, really. I think it's kind of fake. You may think it's not, but I think it is. So light is always mediated by darkness. And so there is not this universal light into which we all just melt into, and there's no ever trace of Tim or Bonnie left. Gate, gate for the rest of our lives. Ooh! Well, that can actually happen in meditation. It can happen. But it's not necessarily good or bad when it happens. The power of meditation is the power of the light of our bare attention to shine on a concrete local condition right here with this heart, with this feeling, with this worry, to shine on it. And if I and not to just exist in some blissed out state, although it sounds nice. And you can actually have these experiences in Zazen. That's, yeah, cool. But not integrated, not integration. The merging of the light and the darkness is what Dogen always talks about. So we don't have to conquer the darkness. We don't have to struggle against it. And we don't have to have that division between things as they are and things as they appear to be that we create. So then Dogen takes a couple of traditional Buddhist metaphors and turns them over, as he's wont to do. He turns them over. One traditional Buddhist metaphor is the metaphor of delusions as flowers in the sky. Flowers in the sky. So this metaphor is a metaphor of how we always are creating our flowers in the sky, always our dreams of what we wish could be, what possibly could be, what might have been, and so we're not here. We're not here. We're just smelling those flowers, just trying to draw those flowers down and make them real. And then the minute we do, they wilt, and we're then hypnotized by those flowers. And so we need to see that those flowers in the sky in our sitting practice, our even sitting practice, that they're just made up stuff. It's all just made up stuff. And when we see that, we can let go of the flowers in the sky and just be in the world. So that's the traditional Buddhist take. And that's great. That's great. I teach that. But then Dogen says, what does Dogen say? Well, what are the flowers in the sky due to in the Buddhist sutras? They're due to dim vision, dim sightedness, because we have cataracts on our eyes, according to the early Buddhist scriptures. Cataracts. And the cataracts are that stuff. All those worries and fears are cataracting us up, right? All those emotional memories that when I see you, I remember you from before, not as you are now. I remember my reaction to you, your reaction to me, so I'm not really with you because of my cataract, right? So the whole Buddhist practice is to get rid of cataracts. Surgically remove the cataracts with your Zazen practice. Surgically remove them, but gentle surgery. Gentle surgery. We're in Soto. In Rinzai, I won't say what kind of surgery they use, but in Soto, it's very gentle surgery. Gentle anesthetic, little by little. But then what does Dogen say? He says, all those flowers in the sky, those are the flowers of emptiness. Those are the flowers of joy. Because they are. They are. So why try to get rid of them? Try to get rid of what is. We all have cataracts. That's the human condition, to have cataracts. Well, we can learn something, we can appreciate, and we can see dimly in spite of our cataracts. And this dim vision is wonderful. We think it's awful. We want to peel them off so we can have the clear-eyedness of Suzuki Roshi when he looks out from the picture, or Tim when he really looks at me. And there's nothing there. Right? They're clear eyes. Everybody wants those clear eyes. We always used to like to try to sit next to Suzuki Roshi, as many of us as possible, so we'd get his vibe and just have that those clear eyes totally penetrate our psyche, that clarity. Well, that's all cool, but be careful. Be careful. Don't turn it into a religion. We get too much religion. Too much religion in our lives, in our Zen. And then it's too bad. We're always unhappy. We're always hungry ghosting it. So dim-sightedness is the condition of all humans. It's not a defect. You don't have to remove it surgically. All you have to do is see that it's part of what is, and authentically take care of it, move from it, learn from it, use it. And then you see, as Dogen said, that it's a flower of emptiness. And remember, emptiness is a positive term for Dogen, for Buddhists. When you think that you don't, if you don't know Buddhism, you don't know. It's a positive term, but it's a positive term because emptiness implies stillness. It implies openness. So that's one way in which he turns the metaphor over. Second metaphor that he takes from traditional Buddhism and is talking about delusion enlightenment is the metaphor of karmic consciousness. Karmic consciousness, right? Most of you know what karmic consciousness means. Very simply, it means that we live within our memories and keep repeating the same habits over and over again based on something that happened to us in the past, our karma, something we did, and creating more and more karma. Buddhists say that karmic consciousness is vast and crazed. It's crazed. My friend, 10 years ago, he had been practicing for 5 years, and he said he's about 50, so 10 years ago he was 40. So for 20 years he had this crazed karmic consciousness in relation to his relationship with women for 20 years. He'd been working with it. And he'd been doing Zazen for 5 years, and for that, previous to that, therapy for 15, right? But he still had it. Karmic consciousness is, in and of itself, is vast and dizzy. That's another translation. Those are my two translations that I'm using. Karmic consciousness is vast and it makes us dizzy that we're so caught by these things, that we're so caught by our past and projecting it into the future, so that we can't just be close to something, so that we can't just be with whomever, whatever. So karmic consciousness is vast and dizzy. And so in the first two paths, in the first path, we, from delusion to enlightenment, we are eradicating karmic consciousness. That's the one I want. I still want that one, right? Everybody wants that one. We're doing the Eightfold Path. We're eradicating it little by little. It takes a while. Maybe, you know, it might take 30, 40, 50 years, but we do eradicate it. Of course, some Buddhists say it takes 30 or 40, 50 lifetimes, but we've never believed that in Zen, because if we did, nobody would ever sit in the cushion. We say, oh, you can do it in this lifetime. You can eradicate it. That's the first one. The second one says, oh, well, it's just this stuff covering it up. Covering up your enlightenment. And so all you have to do is let that shell crack open, and here the enlightenment is. Here it is. It's always here. And the third one says, Stogen says, it's all true. I agree, but. There always is a but in Buddhism, because you clamp down on some teaching. But in Buddhism, we don't clamp down. We don't clamp down. So Dogen says, karmic consciousness in vast and dizzy is the essence of Zen practice. and we should totally embrace it because shine a light on it. That's our enlightenment. We shining a light on that karmic consciousness when it comes up. Right in the cave, right in the shadow, we shine a light on it. And then we appreciate the oneness of darkness and light. But also we appreciate that they're not one. They're one, but they're not one. Something is dark and something is light, but they're one. They're completely the same, but they're not the same. And I'm not being clever, and I'm not talking about something that I learned. I'm not being clever. I don't think I'm very clever. Maybe you think I'm clever. Okay, well, I've been reading lately, so I didn't used to read much about Buddhism. But so, I said to my friend 10 years ago, he said, you know, is it, I don't know if it's distancing or detachment. I said, well, I don't know either. You can look into this. You can look into this when it comes up. Be in your zazen, the light of your meditation, can shine on this, can shine on these feelings that come up, these feelings of being abandoned when she moves away, the feelings of being overwhelmed when she gets close, and then the and then see if it's a distancing and there's some fear there, or if it's just a dropping away. And don't judge it, just see it. Don't then come rush back to me and say what it is. Don't worry about what it is. Just see it. Just see it. So from this point of view, from Dogen's point of view, zazen, Zen meditation, is not a launching pad. We're not launching ourselves to take off, to go someplace and to accomplish something and to be someone or to be no one even. We're not launching ourselves to be no one. We're making our wholehearted effort right now to shine our light just on this, just on this, moment after moment. So, then what's compassion from Dogen's point of view? What's compassion from this point of view of the intimacy between delusion and enlightenment, the oneness which is not oneness? Well, let's first talk about compassion from a traditional Buddhist point of view, okay? Because there's a great teaching in there. Traditional Buddhist point of view, compassion is all about skillful means. Skillful means. Any of you who've hung out here or read books, you know about skillful means. It's about emptying ourselves so we can skillfully help someone based not on our trip, on our idea of how they should be helped, but based on being with them, being open to them, being sensitized to them, a natural empathy, not the empathy that you try to create as a psychotherapist. I don't want to put down psychotherapists, I shouldn't, because I have spent too many years as a psychotherapist myself. Or not too many years, plenty of years. But I'm not doing it anymore. So, skillful means. You empty yourself and then you go with the person. You go with them. You go with them until there's an opportunity to show them something. Show them something from their own turf, from their own psyche, not from yours. And that's how you can really help people. And there's so many examples of this, right? We all have got thousands of examples of this. And sometimes we do it. When we're caught by a situation, we're much less likely to do it. But when we're not caught by a situation, we do do it. Sometimes it's much easier to do it with people we don't know than with people we know, because we can have our beginner's mind. But people we know, it seems very, sometimes almost impossible, especially if we're really close to them, because of all the gunk, right? So that's the traditional Buddhist approach, which I teach here and is taught, I would say, at all the Buddhist centers in the country, probably. And so then Dogen doesn't agree. He just says, well, that's true, but, don't forget that as delusion and enlightenment are this, the means and the ends are this too. So if you get too intelligent about using your skillful means to attain your ends of compassion, you'll start messing things up. Because the means and the end, Dogen would say, he would agree with some philosophers, the ends never justifies the means. It never justifies the means. So any skillful means that's at all manipulative, at all opportunistic, you better be careful of it. It's not really skillful. It's not really skillful. Because the end and the means are no more separate than anything else. And we always need to pay attention to that. Now, supposedly, skillful means would include that. But sometimes we're so caught up on being skillful, on being empty, on being open, that we forget that the ends and the means are one. So that's his critique, his first critique of compassion, as it's taught in traditional Buddhism. he has three critiques. His second critique. Well, in Buddhism we say compassion should be skilled in action, in speech, and thought. You've got to do all three. If you just do your thought, if I just have compassionate thoughts but I don't do anything to support you, what good am I as a friend and a helper? If I just have good actions, if I just pay attention to you and support you while you're giving your talks, and but then my thoughts are all, oh God, is he going to give a talk? You know, I don't know. I'm not going to show up. And so we're talking about congruence, right, between speech, action, and thought. Congruence. And skillfulness, and that's the bodhisattva way. And Dogen says, yes, that's right, but don't be too idealistic about this. Don't be too idealistic about this. Don't forget that even regardless of how strong your light is in the darkness, it's still darkness. You've still got your dizzy karmic consciousness. You've still got your dim-sightedness. Take those into consideration and include those in your compassion. Include those in your compassion. So I talked to my friend Doug about 6 months ago, and Doug, who doesn't live here anymore, and Doug has been now with a woman. He's about 40 for 5 years. This is the longest he's lasted in a relationship. 5 years he's been with her, and he says, he said, well, I said, and how is it? He said, well, it's really good. He said, that stuff is still coming up. It still comes up, but I'm able just to see it so much more often than I could before. And I better be careful saying this to you, Tim, because probably when I get off the phone, he was talking to me on the phone, she'll do something and I'll react and I won't see it. But it's definitely better. Definitely much better. And he said something like, thank you for encouraging me. And I said, you're welcome. You're welcome. So he's including that in his compassion. He's including that in his compassion. We need to include our dizzy karmic consciousness in our compassion, because we ain't going to get rid of it. Even the greatest guru in the world. Now, I don't know the greatest guru in the world, but everybody thinks Suzuki Roshi was the greatest guru in Zen, Soto Zen world. Well, dizzy karmic consciousness. Dizzy, he knew how to be there with it. He knew how to be compassionate for it. Not to transcend, but to shine his light on it. Just to shine his light on it. That's all. Dim-sightedness. Dim-sightedness. Well, at least we have eyes. At least we can see. And so if we can't see, we can feel. We can feel. We can feel. At least we can feel. At least we can hear. Dim. We're all dim-sighted. But dim-sightedness for Dogen is something Dogen gets excited about rather than wanting to get rid of it. He says, dim-sightedness, we can create a universe. Dim-sightedness, we can be open to many things right in the middle of darkness and do something really kind to our own failing eyesight and the own failing eyesight of others. Really support them and really help them in that. So when my second teacher, Katagiri Roshi, was dying of cancer, I had not seen him for... Oh, let's see. I get my years mixed up, but maybe I had not seen him maybe for 5 years. But I went to see him in the hospital when he was dying of cancer, and with my friend. So we went to see him, and his wife was guarding him. His wife Tomoe Katagiri was guarding him. Not too many people come in to see him. If you sew here at Zen Center, you'll get to meet Tomoe. she guards the Dharma, and she was guarding her husband, who was very, very sick, very sick. But she couldn't not let me in because, well, I was actually his first student years ago when he was just a kid and I was younger than a kid, right? And so she couldn't not let me in. So she backed away and I went in to see him with my friend Paul. And there he was. And he saw us and he said, "Oh, wonderful to see you. Wonderful." Like there hadn't been a 5-year gap. Like it was just now. "Wonderful to see you." I was his best friend. Although 5 years before, I just cut out. Boy, talk about distancing. Woo, there's a lot of stuff. A lot of light to shine there, right? But just shine it. Don't make a big deal out of it. Just shine it. Anyway, that's another story. He said, "Oh, Tim Zentetsu." He called me by my Dharma name, right? It doesn't say this, that here, but maybe you can read it. It's just hard to read. Zentetsu, can you see it?
No.
Oh, well, you got to practice with more wholeheartedness. More wholeheartedness. Yes. It says it on the one he wrote, but he didn't write this one. So. Zentetsu, he said, "There's so much I'm going to help people with in Dogen when I come home." He said, "Soon I'll come home and I can show them about Dogen, about how to do Zazen, so that right in the middle of the darkness they can just have a little bit of light and a little bit of joy in their lives. And I'm going to come home soon," he said. Oh, I knew he wasn't coming home soon. I knew he wasn't coming home soon. I knew he was dying. But he had such enthusiasm, just welling up from what? We don't know where it wells up from. It just wells up. The enthusiasm of something. Is it death? Is it life? I don't know. It just wells up. It's just full. Within emptiness, there's just an incredible fullness that comes up. It just comes up. Right in the middle of dim-sightedness. He was totally dim-sighted. He thought he was going to be back next week. He was not going to be back next week. He was not going to be back next month. He was not going to be back next year. He was gyate. He was on his way out. But right in that dim sightedness, the Dharma was blooming. The flowers were in the air. And they were right in the middle of the hospital room. And after that, then I went home and I really practiced, really, like I had never practiced before. For a while. You know, we always do these things for a while, right? Because we are dim-sighted beings. We are dim-sighted beings and we have the dizziness of karmic consciousness. We have it. That's what we have. That's what that friendly Buddha or God or nothingness gave us. Oh boy. Dogen's third limitation on conventional compassion is silence. So, silence. You know, we sit here. I sit here every morning. I've been sitting every morning for 40, 50 years. Long time, right? Long time with a few lapses, but you know, never very long for a lapse. And then all the retreat times I put in, I'm surprised I even have legs left. Sitting cross-legged at my age, my goodness, I'm old, you guys. Anyway, anyway, silence. That's what we do. That's our practice. If you want to be intimate with Zen, you need to be intimate with silence. And the only way you're going to be intimate with silence is to be silent. Duh. And whether you sit in perfect Zazen posture or not does not matter. Whether you sit in half lotus or quarter lotus or no lotus does not matter. Whether you sit in a chair or on the floor does not matter. It just doesn't matter. St- steeping yourself in silence. If you want to know silence, if you want to be silence, if you want to manifest silence, you steep yourself in. That's our practice. That's what we do. Moment after moment, year after year, kalpa after kalpa. So that's how we're compassionate, by steeping ourselves in silence and showing that to others, showing others how to do it. So my story about that, that I've told before, is with my first teacher, Suzuki Roshi. This is one of my stories about it. I'd been doing a lot of meditation at our Zen monastery. I came back from our Zen monastery. I went to the Asian Art Museum in San Francisco in a very sensitized state. I saw all these empty Buddhas and Bodhisattvas looking out at me on one floor, first floor, second floor, third floor, China, Japan, Thailand. I was very sensitized. And the emptiness was too much for me. It was too much for me. It just overwhelmed me. My body kind of just froze. I just felt despair at that much emptiness. Despair, deep despair. Nothing to hold on to. Nothing to depend on. I was trying to find one of the Buddhas on one of the floors, but for some reason I didn't encounter any of them. Because some Buddhas sometimes have something in their eyes, but these are just empty, empty, empty. Of course, it was really me, but anyway, that's what it seemed like. And I was just in despair, and I kind of staggered out of the museum. This is a true story. I don't think I'm embellishing it. It could be, but I don't think so. And I got on the bus, and I was just kind of a wreck, but I was containing it. I was containing it rather than spilling all over. And so I just, I just bussed toward my teacher, bussed toward where he lived, Suzuki Roshi. And so I bussed toward there. I got out and was able to walk, but still just incredible of the emptiness and the futility of everything. The futility of nothing is permanent, as nothing is as it seems, if we can't count on anything, if everything's changing, then total futility, totally futile. And so I just went up to see him, and he saw me, and he had his wife, Oksan, come give us some tea, and we sat down. And he asked me some questions about what was going on, and I told him, and then he wanted to know what statue I'd looked at, which I thought was totally irrelevant. What floors was I on? I said we were going to do a tour of the Asian Art Museum. But anyway, he said that, and then he was quiet. Then he was just quiet. He didn't say anything more. We drank tea, and for maybe 15 minutes, he didn't say a word, nothing. But I just felt relieved. And by the time I left, I still felt still inside, but I didn't feel scared anymore. I didn't feel desperate anymore. I didn't feel like everything was futile. I just went home and took a long, long nap. And then went back to Zazen the next morning. Being the kind of stubborn person I am, went right back to Zazen. But that was using silence. He didn't, except for those questions, he just using silence. We use silence. That's our primary tool in Zen. That's partly the reason I like it better than being a therapist. Although some therapists are using silence now. They're pretty good. You should go to one of those. So that's here's the traditional take, and I believe it completely. Well, then Dogen says, wait a second here. And he talks about Vimalakirti. Vimalakirti is known for being the master of silence. And all the Buddha sent all the bodhisattvas to see Vimalakirti, one after another, and ask Vimalakirti questions and hang out with Vimalakirti. And Vimalakirti maintains during a very large portion of the sutra a singular, thunderous silence which transcends speech and thought. And that's what he does. That's mostly what happens. And Dogen rails against Vimalakirti. He rails against Vimalakirti. Talk about having preferences. Think you're going to get rid of your preferences after you practice? Well, look at our hero. Although sometimes he loves Vimalakirti. I sometimes feel like he's being dramatic for his students, since as I have been known to be. He rails against him. He says, silence is not privileged. There is no more difference between silence and sound, silence and language, than there is between delusion and enlightenment. This is something you made up. You've got the idea of silence as being privileged. So you deify, you reify silence at the expense of words, at the expense of talking, at the expense of sharing, at the expense of creating, at the expense of expressing. And there's no more duality between silence and sound than there is between delusion and enlightenment. There is a duality, but intimacy, closeness is what this is all about. Closeness. So when we speak, if we speak genuinely, then the silence is there. So too much in religious traditions, people hide behind silence. They did it in my grandma's church. Well, they didn't do it in the Unitarian Church. Unitarians do not hide behind silence. You can go there. They don't. But Unitarians that I grew up with didn't know silence. They just knew, talking. That's all they knew. Talking, talking, talking. Maybe modern Unitarians are different. But those Unitarians, we did a lot of talking. So, this practice that Dogen's talking about is not distancing, not using silence to distance, okay? So my friend Doug, when I talked to him on the phone, whenever that was, most recently he said, and now when this stuff comes up, I talk with Nancy. I talk with her. And he said, but I don't talk with her until I've cooled off enough so I can say to her, I'm feeling like I need to distance myself, and this is what's going on, Nancy, and I'm just not sure what it is, but I need your help. I need your help. Now he's doing that. Now he's using compassionate language in the relationship instead of sacred distancing. And I'm using that word it's a two-sided word, right? Sacred distancing. Sacred distancing is not sacred from the Zen point of view. Not sacred. So, one last story. This Dogen, one of Dogen's stories, one of Dogen's stories that he likes about enlightenment. He likes this story in particular because it talks about compassion, and we're studying this story in our Thursday morning study group. I don't think. Oh, Greg's here. Yes, we're studying this story in our Thursday morning study group. So this is about Avalokiteshvara Bodhisattva, the Bodhisattva of compassion. Okay, Bodhisattva of compassion, who is all hands and eyes, right? All hands and eyes. That way he can help all beings, extend himself in a multiplicity of ways, skillful means. So this is from Tang Dynasty China, and Dogen quotes it. Ungan once asked Dogo, what does the Bodhisattva of compassion do with so many hands and eyes? Dogo replied, he is like someone in the night who reaches behind himself, his hand groping for his pillow. He is like someone in the night who reaches behind himself, his hand groping for the pillow. Ugon remarked, I get it, I get it. Dogo asked, what did you get? Unga said that his whole body is hand and eyes. That his whole body is hands and eyes. So, first, this is kind of self-explanatory, isn't it? This is kind of self-explanatory, that when our whole body is hands and eyes, when we really engage in wholeheartedly being with each other, that we are compassionate, that compassion comes out. when we don't distance ourselves, and when we even include our dizzy karmic consciousness in that and treat it as a friend, not as an enemy, because it's what part of what is, it's what is. That then we really, there is compassion. And then what does Dogen say about this? He says, there is something we need to investigate in the saying, groping for a pillow. He says, if we investigate what underlies Dogen's saying, in the night, reaching behind himself, his hand groping for a pillow, if we investigate that, says Dogen, we need to see and not disregard the eyes that show you the night. We need to see and not disregard the night eyes. And then he says, a hand that is groping for a pillow has not yet touched its edge. Not yet touched its edge. Within our dim vision, we will never touch the edge. And we don't need to touch the edge because our dim vision is pretty wonderful. Pretty wonderful, just as it is. Just as it is. So those night eyes, those eyes that show us the night, they're always illuminating. The moon is always illuminating the shadow. It doesn't matter what the shadow is, how big it is, how scary it is, how confusing it is. And the moon does that softly, with softness. Not the harshness of the sun, but with great kindness and love. Right within light, there is darkness. Right within light, there is darkness, but don't see it as darkness. Right within darkness, there is light, but don't see it as light. I think that's what I want to say this morning, but I'll be glad to entertain questions or comments or stories or songs or poems or fairy tales or nursery rhymes or whatever. Anybody?
You used the moon as a regular example, and you called to the harshness of the sun. Would you be able to use the sun just for the fun of it?
Yeah, we can use the sun for the fun of it, but for this metaphor, we're using the moon. I mean, we can use the sun in another metaphor. There are other metaphors about the sun. We could use metaphors about the sun, yes. And I could even think one up now, but I'm not going to, because I'm not that smart. And of course, I guess I'm going to say something. We talk about the clear sky. I talk about the clear sky, which really is emptiness. The sky is always clear. And even when the sun is down, the sun is illuminating the sky. It's illuminating those stars. It's illuminating the moon. It's illuminating everything. So the sun in its absence is totally present. It's totally present. And sometimes in its complete absence, it's more present. Because you just see one star, and that one star has an effect on you, pierces you to the core the way the whole galaxy wouldn't. Do you want to try? Okay.
I just didn't want to leave here being anti.
Oh, right. Good.
Person.
Yeah, okay. Well, that's not the... Well, of course, it's yin-yang, you know. The Chinese would get into that big time, that the moon is yin and the sun is yang, and we need them both. And Dogen talks about yin-yang, too. I mean, really, this delusion enlightenment thing is a yin-yang thing. goes back to Taoism.
Tim?
Yeah.
The use of the word groping.
Ah.
The use of the word groping.
Yes.
The presence of that word jumped out at me.
Yeah.
And somehow seems very forgiving. So
somehow
I'd never sort of glossed over it.
So great. So, yeah, do you have something more to say to that?
No, that's it.
Yeah, I think you're right. We need to be very forgiving. We need to be very forgiving. And we need to always start with ourselves. If we leave ourselves out, how can we really forgive the other? How can we really forgive the other? Now, I say that to most of you. There are a few of you I want to say the opposite to. But not too many of you Zen students. Most of you Zen students that I work with, you need to forgive yourselves. I don't know why, but that's where you need to start. If I was hanging out of prison, then I would probably have a, you know, with prisons, if I was presenting at Stillwater Prison, I would say, don't forget the other, please. Don't forget the other. Okay, anything else? Nobody?